said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
You know you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with author, psychologist, and dear friend, John O'Neill. He's been the president of the California School of Professional Psychology. He's been a leadership coach. He's written books like The Very Profound Paradox of Success, Leadership Aikido, and Seasons of Grace, which is a wonderful book about gratitude that he wrote with the head of Alan Jones, the head of the Grace Cathedral. John, I'm reaching out to you today. Thank you for joining me. But I can feel within my bones an urgency. This is a great time of disorientation, a great time of despair, a time of transformation. And you've had these beautiful conferences. And most importantly, a long time ago, after I got off an airplane from going from Kennedy Airport to Beijing, and I hadn't taken anything to read, I ran to the bookshop and I got this book called The Paradox of Success, and I read it. And when I got to the World Economic Forum, you were running a panel, and I became a client, and you helped me sort myself out in one of the most disoriented, confusing times of my life. So in a disoriented, confusing time for society, I couldn't imagine bringing a greater gift to my audience than inviting you to explore with me here tonight. So thanks for being a part of this.
Well, you're welcome. I'm delighted. I'm just delighted.
Well, John, you are also, I'm going to go right to the heart of the matter at the outset. You've recently written a book that hasn't been released yet called Life the Whole Enchilada. And you've created a wonderful nudge in your profile of me where you said I was too media shy. And if you said to me, who's my co-author and founding this podcast, there is no question that it was when I read that paragraph in Gulf, I said, I better get on my horse, John's beckoning me. But John, where we are right now, lots of social unsustainability, lots of despondent politics, lots of fear of climate change, and then this pandemic comes down like an alien on the planet Earth. And I want to hope that it's a gift because it was disorienting an unsustainable system. But it's too daunting to be that cheerful at the outset. How are you seeing what's happening? You've worked with powerful people as a life coach, many, many people who are in the, what you might call the pantheon of American awareness and heroes. What are you seeing, and what are you recommending and teaching people in this dreadful experience?
Well, thanks, Rob. It's a great pleasure to be here. Let me go quickly through the setup so I kind of understand where you want to go and make sure I'm going in the right direction. Let's start with where we are. Let's identify it properly because we so often don't, and that's understandable since we live in the present. And we're now experiencing the future that we've never seen and we don't understand. There are three parts to the future, as I see it, that are hitting us sort of almost all at once. The first part is we had a very flawed economic system that has kind of held us up in a curious way. It's floated us, if you will. You can imagine humanity floating on a sea of economic nonsense. So that's number one. That's been going on for some time, and you and others have been trying to call attention to that. The second thing is this thing called climate change, which is very slow. It makes market crashes look almost speedy, as it were. But when you have something as grand and as horrible as we have been treating the earth, our tribe, if you will, has been deliberately trying to destroy the earth as best they can, without knowing that's what they're doing, by just gouging it, taking a piece here, a piece there, letting this go by the way, whatever pleases us. In fact, there's a very interesting group of Israelis who wrote a book called Sapiens.
And
I've been deep into that and into the heads of those guys, and they've got a full understanding, I think, of how serious this is, how deliberate it is, and how hard it is to turn around. It's not easy at all. And then the third thing is the consequences of climate change may be reinforcing the pandemic. So if it didn't reinforce this one, it will the next one, because climate deeply affects how we interact with each other. And as you know, this is not the first, not the last pandemic. We'll have more. And climate change, in addition to all the other things it's doing to affect our lives, is deeply, deeply affecting in the case of something like a pandemic, a new disease. So there's all the good news right up front. That's where we are. Let's don't blow it. Let's don't put any kind of machine on it. What let's do is to try to understand how we got here. And when Europe was in deep trouble back in the 20s and the 30s, really deep trouble, and it suddenly erupted in the form of Nazi Germany, we were surprised, but if you did just a little bit of work, you could see where all the shadows were all over Europe, dark, dark shadows. I'm reading another Churchill book I've written. A lot have been written about him. They're all pretty good, and this one is very good. And Churchill saw these shadows, and he was almost panicky about it. He had a kind of sensitivity to it. He saw the dark thing that was happening, and so did Carl Jung, and so did Freud. And they were the ones who gave it the name shadow. Mm-hmm. And what it is, it's all the repressed anger and fear that we walk around with every day suddenly comes to the surface, and we see really frightening, horrible things happening. And that's what happened in Nazi Germany. You can read that in great detail. So we know that, and we know that we have shadows all over the place. Our society right now is probably filled with shadows that we have never really believed we would have. We have shadows of the most horrible kind of bigotry that's just coming, oozing out of it's almost like it's part of the plant that we call the earth. It's just oozing out. We have shadows around hate and frankly, and injustice that have gone on for years and years. They're now coming to the surface. And as we squeeze everyday life for people, more and more of these shadows will start to surface. Now, some of them could wake us up, which would be nice. That would be lovely. But most of them, unfortunately, right now, are just leading us in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think what they're doing is really leading us as a humanity into the direction of some kind of game, zero-sum game, in which if I sit in here in the U.S. and you sit just south of the border of the U.S., you're less significant than I am. You're less worthwhile in terms of what I should do for you. In short, we become provincial. We become really ugly in our hatred. And we've got to turn all that around. All that shadow has to be released. And if I didn't learn anything else from Jung, it's that if you don't get things out of the shadow in your own personal life, in your society, they're going to come back and they're really going to haunt you. And that's where we are.
Yeah, and when you talk about climate change in your three-part context of where we are, ugliness, hatred, provincial. It takes my mind right to the United States and China, who must collaborate on climate change, pandemics, and many other issues for this planet to survive.
Yeah.
And we're going in the wrong direction at high velocity right now in terms
Absolutely.
Of that cooperative and collaborative spirit.
So when did that start in your mind, Rob? When did we start to turn that corner?
Oh, in the U.S.-China relationship, I'm quite attentive, as you know. I was flying from Beijing to Davos when I first met you.
That's right.
I ran the Soros Quantum Emerging Growth in the non-Japan Asia portfolio in those days, and I've stayed very devoted to them and that region and its implications to the world ever since. And what I would say is, John, there's a kind of rough and tumble political economy. And you see America, multinational enterprise in particular, going over foreign direct investment, technology diffusing into China, taking advantage of low environmental restrictions, low labor costs, and exporting back to the United States. What we saw in that context was very, very disruptive influence, particularly in the manufacturing sector in the United States. But what we saw was when the currency, the Chinese renminbi, was misaligned, when it was undervalued with the dollar, a whole bunch of powerful interests in the United States, Nike, Walmart, people who benefited from foreign direct investment, tried to stop the United States government from complaining and demanding adjustment. Wall Street wanted access to the financial market of China as it modernized and integrated with the rest of the world. So there was what I'll call the Pepsi dream. Pepsi or Coca-Cola can sell 1.2 billion consumers, huge scale. And all of those dreams carry us from the 1990s, maybe even a little earlier, in the era of Deng Xiaoping, through the WTO. And this is before Donald Trump. The Chinese started to have to improve their environmental conditions. The Chinese started to have to raise the compensation of their workforce as they were moving towards the middle income status. And many people were migrating to the coastline. The Chinese had a lot of woundedness from the Opium War, had a lot of woundedness from the Japanese invasion during the war, the Second World War. And the dignity of that nation, which was once called the Middle Kingdom, was harmed, was wounded, and they sought to regain their stature. Around 2015, and this is really to answer your point, the Chinese did not choose to integrate their financial market. They compartmentalized their market, maintained and intensified capital controls.
Right.
American technology firms were finding, instead of the magic, what I call the Coca-Cola dream, the Chinese were learning the technology and then replicating the firm right next door. And the state management would facilitate growth of market share by the domestic firm, not by the joint venture.
Right.
The rising labor standards and the rising wages compressed the profits of the traditional Chinese foreign direct investments owned by the West. And I would say, finally, the Chinese announced a program called China 2025, which discussed displacing knowledge-intensive systems or sectors of production with Chinese domestic firms including things like the Silicon Valley, the Amazons and Googles and so forth, being held out and domestic alternatives. So the Americans said, in a model of comparative advantage, they didn't meld with our system. They didn't converge with our system. They didn't allow us market share and benefits. And even in 2014 and 15, places as multilateral as the Council on Foreign Relations were writing angry, hostile, national state strategy anti-Chinese reports.
Yeah.
Add to that that the workforce that had been displaced in manufacturing watched a deregulation, tax cuts for the wealthy, and a gutting of their infrastructure and school systems and no adjustment systems. And that's not the Chinese fault. That's the response of the American plutocratic governance. So you had two wings. The powerful felt like they had to develop a tougher stance vis-a-vis China, and the people who'd been displaced were bitter and despairing.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump brought those signals together. But those reports and those episodes that I described here in a long-winded way were all available on January 10th of 2015. And he didn't get elected until November of 2016.
Right.
The Chinese will say to you, we never intended to converge and become free market capitalism. We have a different social system and a social philosophy, and that was your illusion, not ours.
Yeah. Well, the other little factor that I remember, I think you told me, was Japan. Japan had really come up. In fact, if you remember a wonderful book my friend Tony Athos wrote called Japanese system, or the Japanese method. And what it said was really they understood how to do manufacturing, that Japan really had conquered that, and they were going to take over manufacturing. And the Chinese took that very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they did was they began to steal all of Toby's work because they thought he had the right idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the paradox came out and it took off in Japan, which surprised them, and South Korea started to buy a lot of copies, China decided to publish it themselves. And so they didn't bother telling us about it. They just went ahead and published it and then distributed it to the first year class of every college student in China.
Wow.
And why? Why did they do that? Because they saw what happened to Japan was that as soon as they got successful, really successful, they started to blow it. And they really gave away their advantage. And we remember that very well. So China's been playing the long game and the short game. We always want to give them one game or the other.
Well, you're right. Because around the time I met you, 1995, I think we met, but 94, the Chinese did a massive devaluation. And before that, the Japanese were doing their outward foreign direct investment in Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia, and it reoriented. The Asia crisis of the late 1990s, 97, 98, was the byproduct of the 94 devaluation.
Yep.
Which just reoriented all production towards China and away from the ASEAN constellation. So the Japanese were outsourcing and faltering at home, and then China accelerated that and drew the energy to their platform, their country.
Yeah, exactly. They also revamped their educational system, which we don't need to go into here, but they were playing many, many, many sides to this game. And frankly, they just saw that we were just getting behind, that we were getting lazy. We were getting very self-satisfied. We were bragging about how good we were, always a bad thing. And they saw that, and Japan and China both took advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, Rob, are you engaging these days much in given the pandemic, what comes next? And then what is it that we need to be doing? People like us, what do we need to be doing to help out in the effort?
Very much at the center of our inquiry. I mean, John, I start with the Institute for New Economic Thinking in the realm of ideas. The dysfunction that you described, the failure of the economy, the challenge of climate, the pandemic, is an unmasking.
Okay.
No one can stand up at this juncture.
Right.
Even when people are afraid and want to cling to the familiar of the past, they cannot stand up and tell you the orthodox economic model will deliver you from evil.
Right.
Because
right.
It's like Rome's burning here. And,
exactly.
And we can't be fiddling. So it is in the intellectual realm, the question of what do people trust, believe in, what I will call the collapse in the integrity and trust in expertise, which has got a lot of negative consequences. But the question of the resurrection of expertise is a part of INET's view. But John, what's interesting to me is these are not disembodied mechanical exercises. These are emotional, textured exercises. And you have worked with leaders. Leaders probably are susceptible to thinking that their formula that brought them to power and strength might be good for all time.
That's right.
They become systemic conservatives. They become defending of what Ernest Becker would call their legacy or their immortal identity that exists beyond their bodily life.
Right.
How do you break leadership out of those crutches and put them on the path of truly leading, evolving the dynamic, and being truly great, which deserves a legacy? How you live in tutoring people, including myself, but much higher level people. How do you help that process?
Well, recently, Rob, I've been doing two things, and they both seem to be working, and I don't want to say enough to brag about them, but one of them is insist I won't work with any company now unless they give me 10 questions that are vexing them that they must answer in the next 5 years. 10 questions. And they're big ones. I mean, they can't just be trivial. They have to be really serious. And one of them is a very large transportation company that everybody knows the name of. And they're now working on the sixth. That was 2 years ago when I did that presentation. They're now working on their sixth big crackthrough that'll keep them afloat. Transportation is really up for grabs. They know it. They're very smart people. And so that's the first thing I do, is insist that they claim their problems. In other words, to translate that into Jungian speak, it's insist that they look at the shadows. What's brought them here? What makes them great? What do they brag about in all their ads? Well, that's where your shadows are. Let's get on with it. The second thing is that I insist that they form teams, and that those teams be extremely well-balanced, even if they have to go outside the company. Well-balanced in every possibility, so that they don't have a bunch of people from the staff sitting on these committees. They can have a feet to one, but that's it. And so the same company had teams of 10 there, and they cut those back to 8 because it's a global company, and they were having a hard time sustaining that. But that's what's solving the problem, is what is it that we as a team can understand and get our arms around and solve?
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to make the difference in our business and to our customers. And the whole exercise starts with a deep understanding of what their customers are going through, especially if they don't know their customers very well. And in this case, this company is in so many different business lines that they know just a little bit about their customers, but not a lot. So that's today's exercise. It doesn't sound very exciting or glamorous, but it's quite effective.
Well, at some level, it's not wasting your time. Because unless they're prepared, they can't impart and benefit. You can't impart to them and them benefit from your insights and wisdom. So why bother when there's all kinds of yearning out there for you to serve? So I think
it's interesting how quickly big global companies say, yeah, you're right. I mean, they absolutely see it. And they just never have known quite what to do about it, or it's come to them in different pieces and never as a global problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And how about individual leaders? How do you, what I would call, help them evolve into a constructive and less fearful or defensive posture?
Well, that takes much more time, unfortunately. So the first thing is they have to spend their first year when we're together digging into their shadows. Where are they? What are they? How do they get there? How are they going to get rid of them? And that really turns out to be the most exciting part of the exercise. They love it.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is they have to go back into their businesses or their investments and take another look and see if those are lined up with their soul. If you don't have investments that are lined up with your soul, you and your team are destined to create real trouble in the world for yourself
mm-hmm.
and everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And the third thing I think that happens over and over with individuals, Rob, is that the shadows keep growing, the ego keeps getting bigger and juicier, and they just simply have to go through a number of exercises to get that back in some kind of shape.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially if they had a serious damage like you did, where they had a big overnight success and there was no time for anybody to be prepared for it. So then you had to go back and dig out and say, okay, what happened here?
What did
I run into? What looked so good that turned out to be so mean?
I remember those days when I was disoriented and shuddering and
yeah,
that people wouldn't let me watch soccer games to my children because they all wanted to do business deals or trying to cotton up to a girl's partner.
Right.
I felt more lonely when I was being pursued like that than I ever have since or before.
Oh, yeah.
As you know, I clung to my buddies from Detroit to get grounded because I knew that there was love between us that existed before that crazy fanfare. And I remember a reading that you sent me. There's an Indian guru, Sri Ramana Maharshi.
Maharshi.
And there was a woman who was a disciple. Her name was Lucy Cornelson.
Oh my God! You remember that?
called Hunting the Eye. And
wow.
I remember sitting down with this thing, because there was all this kind of artificial aggrandizement in it, and I was dissatisfied. I was not in a place that I thought was resonant with where I wanted to be. I kept saying to me, this has got to be a chapter, not the whole book. But when I read Lucy Cornelson's Hunting the Eye, and Hunting the Eye was the title paraphrase, which said essentially, when you're unhappy, you start to dig in. And when you finally dig in, the thing you're hunting, your own ego. And until you break through that, you're not on a path towards what they would call enlightenment or a deeper sense of purpose.
Right.
And I felt like I'm hunting myself. I used to look in the mirror and say that. You were like, how would I say, my advisor in the field to kill this animal.
That's it. You gotta find it.
But I think, John, you know, my intuition here is that for us collectively and individually to make progress, it is precisely at the times that people are most disoriented and anxious that they can become most defensive.
Yep. Right.
And I remember reading, there's a wonderful philosopher named Stephen Toulmin. He wrote a book about the The Hidden History of Modernity. It's called Cosmopolis. And in the book, he said, you could see After the 30 Years' War, how everybody was afraid, they went into this abstract place that we now call the Cartesian Enlightenment.
All right.
And the humanism of Shakespeare and the humanism of, I'm trying to remember the famous French humanist, starts with an M, Montaigne.
Montaigne. Yeah.
And these people were almost extinguished in terms of the mindset. And then you applied the technocratic disciplines, the mechanical disciplines that worked well in the natural sciences, the social science, and what Toulmin says, and then the fault lines just became so big and so vivid. But every time you had a social breakdown, people got so scared, they lurched back to the familiar, not forward to the evolution. And the case study in his book was the civil rights movement, the 1960s, the Eastern philosophy, the enlightenment of different ways of seeing, and the anti-war movement obviously fueled some of that. And then everybody lurched back into what I'll call the years of Reagan and the nostalgia. And he wrote the book about all of these episodes, but the culminating chapters were those. And so I guess it's a long-winded way of asking you a question. What do we do now? What do we do now so that we don't sit in the fetal position, drink too much, huddle around our past successes? How do we help people leap forward and embrace this very complex and disorienting failure of many of our systems and put Humpty Dumpty back together again?
Right. Okay. Well, first of all, we have to completely revise and update and clean up the education system. We are not educating people. We haven't for a long time. We are at best training them and training them to be technocrats.
Yeah.
And we're afraid of true education. We're afraid because true education, as we all know, is based on questions. Ask the great mystics, ask the great philosophers, questions. And we become terrified of questions. And I wasn't going to use Trump, but I have to. One of the worst and saddest tragedies that we're witnessing here is his inadequate capacity to frame a good question.
Mm-hmm.
Questions terrify poor Donald, because poor Donald doesn't know how to even attack one sensibly and honestly. He throws some kind of TV made-up language at the question and then walks away and pretends that it didn't happen. And so we're stuck for this little tiny period right now that we're in.
Yep.
Until we get on the other side of this and begin to really ask questions. So I'm going to give you a hint about what I'm going to tell Joe Biden when he calls.
All right.
So Biden's going to call and he's going to say, what can I do at this stage? Because the world is coming apart and they don't want to hear a political speech. And I'm going to say, yes, don't do that. No political speeches, no pious babble. But what you can do is begin to get people acquainted with the big questions that have to be raised. Where are we going? How are we going to get there? Who's going to take us there? What are the big barriers that we face? How can we use our generosity and warmth and love in our favor, as opposed to turning that into some kind of acidic process that destroys everything we see? And I'm going to ask him to appoint his new cabinet. I'm following Doris Kearns Goodwin's great book and say, okay, starting tomorrow, these are the people I'm going to have around me. And I'm promising them a job in the cabinet. We'll sort out what the exact details of how that's going to work. But in the meantime, I've asked them all to address the biggest three questions that they know of in their realm. So if they're in HEW, what are the three biggest questions there, and so forth. wherever their center of expertise is. And we've seen what this nice Italian frail doctor has done with the pandemic. He's gradually taken over the leadership of that, whatever there is, because he's honest and he's decent and he asks good questions and he doesn't pretend like he knows everything.
Yeah.
So if Joe had a cabinet like that, that just kind of, just honestly, just filled the room with that kind of energy, that kind of a remarkably exciting adventure, we'd all want to go. We'd all want to jump on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what Joe's going to hear from me when he calls, and I hope
okay. What was Lawrence Goodwin's book, you said? Is that Democratic Promise?
Team Arrivals.
Okay.
Yeah, Lincoln's cabinet.
Oh, right.
And you remember, Rob, he promised those people their cabinet positions when they were still in Chicago at the convention.
That's right.
So that way he let out to the party bosses, we're going to be in good hands. We're not going to have any really horrible people. On the other hand, he reassured a lot of people that they were going to have a real job to do, and they weren't coming just to fill up seats.
Yes. Well, I'm very interested. I know, John, you've been involved in the relationship between technology and broadening the dissemination and access to education.
There you go.
And the other dimension that I'm also powerfully impacted by is one of the future guests on this podcast, and man who's been a fellow at INET, Michael Sandel. He's writing a book right now.
Sure, I remember him.
We did a video course for students together, a six-hour course called What Money Can't Buy, Morals and Markets.
Oh, my. And he is so good.
And he's got a new book now that's in process coming out probably in the fall called The Tyranny of Meritocracy. And I know other William Dereswitch at Yale has one called Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite.
Yeah.
And what interests me here is that when you watch Trump get elected, I'm really looping back to his incapacity to be supple and empathetic and confident in the intellectual realm, actually met with some applause because a whole lot of people felt like elite degrees were not a symbol of someone who had earnestly gone deep and broad and had gifts of lateral pattern recognition and could synthesize, say, from a position of leadership and governance for the common good. They viewed these people as getting a certificate to membership in an elite club that was a marketing agency for plutocracy and corporate power. And so the excellent sheep were becoming what you might call, in the knowledge-intensive, inputs to production and legitimation. And they weren't dealing with the big questions, because the big questions are often paradoxical. They involve dilemmas. They have a sense of poetic provocation. They're unsettling to people who are self-satisfied with their existing power.
Precisely.
And I really have been interested in your passion through your Good Life series, which I've attended and enjoyed greatly, and through our conversations about how not only do you want to reform the dissemination of education, but the content of what is in that education. And the things you had us reading were old Shakespearean plays and philosophical tracts and biographies of fascinating people like Churchill. How do we not only use technology to create broader access, but reset what is the priority of content to create a more soulful society and leadership within that society?
Well, we probably need right away something like, well, what David Brooks asked for this morning was trivial compared to what we really need. We need a WPA for the mind and the soul. We need big projects rescuing kids, rescuing people who are on the streets and so forth. Not just rescuing them to feed them and put them in some kind of housing. What we need is to rescue them as people before they get there if we can, and then help them find their way out on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires a huge, huge undertaking. It's the WPA of the mind and the soul, and we need that now. We need it right today. And if we just change people a little bit, or if we just give them enough hot food and housing to keep going while we create another one of these problems, we haven't done a damn thing. So
right.
We need to get on with real, real examination at the roots of our society. Why are we here? What are we doing? Why do we need so damn many of us? We don't. How are we going to deal with climate change? Those questions alone would bring us to our knees if we truly address them.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I see a lot of people, which you might call working to disseminate those STEM disciplines to the emerging countries and poorer regions within the advanced countries and so forth. And that's not a bad thing.
No.
But I think the deepening of that curriculum, of the sense, defining the sense of collective and individual purpose from a deeper place,
that's
also a missing ingredient.
Huge ingredient. And that, by the way, is the job of tomorrow's leader that we need, the one we need, right there.
Yeah.
That's the job. And we have lost so, we were so far away from that, it's just almost scary how far away. And yet, I'm not pessimistic. I think we can do it. I think we can do it. If I can watch some huckster from New York have as much power and wield it and make, create so much damage, what would it be like if we found someone who was really good and she started to ask these questions and get us to ask them?
Yes.
So we've proven we can destroy. Now let's prove we can build.
And I know, Harold, I said, I can't remember what you described people at in your new book. You're the whole enchilada. Life, the whole enchilada, I recall, was the working title. But
exactly.
You had people who were like shapers. And then
shapers?
You had people, they were like shapers of the future, or I can't remember what, how you described it, but there were sort of certain people that were like embodiment of wisdom.
Right, that's right.
Emphasized. And then there were other people who were like examples. And it was just fascinating for me to see, you know, how you wove the Nelson Mandelas and others into this vision. And it was done beautifully in the, because I can feel your professional experience, the different stages of life require different, different transitions and different types of wisdom and different types of teaching. I always remembered, can't remember who was it that said, her name was Pearson, and she said, the hardest transition for a man is to go from being the warrior to being the wizard. You're done with your accomplishments, and now you're trying to impart goodness and elevation for other people. And she was sort of a Joseph Campbell style of writer, and I'll have to dig that up. I remember James Hollis writing a lot about these issues as well.
That's right.
Passages in the middle of life, and particularly he focused in some of his writings. What was the one on Under Saturn's Shadow?
That's it.
I remember that was a book that you turned me on to as well. You talk also about in the mature years. We have people who are very powerful and elderly, and books like, what was Helen Luke's book, Old Age?
Yeah, right.
Her chapter, The Winnowing Fan, about
That's
the
it.
Kind of fantasy beyond Homer's Odyssey. That there was a passage in Homer's Odyssey which talked about what you had to do to evolve to the next stage. It was left there, and she wrote the story of what should have been what you might call the story that fulfilled that curiosity.
That's correct.
And but I'm just curious, what it, for people 55 and over, other than the paradox of success, Aikido leadership, where do you take those people so that they don't feel powerless or helpless or put out to pasture in this new technological age? How do you, what's your call to action to them?
Well, I think, thank you. My feeling is that you named most of the people for whom we should express our eternal gratitude. Okay, you named most of them. Our teachers, right? Our mentors. The people who I call wisdom carriers. People who brought a little bit of wisdom to a young guy in Detroit just at the right moment. And it took him in a whole direction that he never knew existed. And then these lovely people called character shapers. And I love that name because it really means that they came along and in their own way shaped our characters. And we may or may never, have actually thanked them for it. So now's our time to thank them. Now's our time to show our gratitude. Because without them, without a John Gardner in my case, my mm-hmm. life would have been very, very different. Without a Nelson Mandela who came into my life, it would have been very different for me. And so forth. Each one brought something. And the proximity didn't matter as much as our readiness to listen. That's what mattered.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you meet someone like that, for me, I think it was Eleanor Roosevelt when I was just a kid, it just changed somehow how I thought about the world. Because the questions Eleanor Roosevelt asked me raised me 10 feet off the floor because she really was honoring me with those questions. And I felt like, hey, I can go do things. I can go do a lot. So those are the people, Rob, that I think we need a lot more of, and we need to recognize them. And the funny thing is you don't need to pay them huge salaries. They really like doing what they do and wouldn't do anything else.
Yeah. But they, in essence, they're not working for money. They're working for mission.
That's exactly right. And they love learning themselves. So it just makes their lives so happy to help teach a grateful student. Well, it does you and me. I mean, we're very grateful. Occasionally when we get a student who comes along and says, you know, I want to know something. Boy, it feels so good.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And so, John, I think you ought to be in Joe Biden's cabinet. if this was the circus, you should be the ringmaster. If you had a way of being the person that could filter out who belongs and who doesn't in that role of leadership. With all the teaching, I remember Joel Henderson was a big teacher of yours.
Big teacher,
and all the people that you've shared with me, all the ways that I've come to understand my own challenges. If you were sitting at Joe Biden's side, and or whoever is the president's side, but I think you'll be talking to him. If you were sitting with him, you can recognize the character, the sense of purpose, and help people refine and evolve that. And I think it could transpire. You could bring it off. I mean, I remember reading George Leonard's book, Mastery.
That's
your
right.
Initiative.
That's right.
And Gifts from the Sea, which was an easy one because I was a sailor. And there were just so many different poems and things that that jog me. I kind of like, I feel like I want to raise money so if Joe Biden's elected, he can use half the money for his election campaign fund. The other half is to support your office in his White House.
Well, I would be honored to help set something like that up. That would be great fun. So if you run into an opportunity to do it, let's do it together, okay?
All right. As you said in your reference to me in your latest book, that we need, as Dylan Thomas said, to all go bravely into the dark night.
That's right.
I know you're the guy with the flashlight. So I want to thank you for being with me today and exploring, and I want to reserve the right in a few months' time to call you back. It might be the day after Election Day to see how I can impart what you've taught me and help you impart to this next administration these necessary ingredients so that we can evolve.
That would be lovely. Thank you so much. This has been great fun, my friend.
Yeah.
Never know where you're going to pop up. And Davos one day, and the next day, I'm in Sausalito. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Thank you.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.